It's getting easier because the concept is only relevant for CD sales and full album downloads, which are dying. It's also possible to get escalations based on sales of the album. An exception to all this is where the soundtrack album is the same label to whom you're signed. In that case, you should get no less than the royalty you have under your record deal. For a featured instrumentalist or a featured vocalist, which we discussed earlier in this chapter, royalties are in the range of 9% to 10%, prorated based on the number of album cuts, and further prorated if you're performing with another royalty artist. For example, if you sing with an orchestra that gets a royalty. The record company piece. Record companies want to collect all the royalties you get from soundtrack recordings. They normally keep 50% as a cost of waiving your exclusivity and allowing your recording to be released on somebody else's label. If you have an enormous amount of bargaining power, you may be able to beat them down below 50%, but it's getting tougher to pull this off. However, if your company happens to be distributing the soundtrack album, you should ask for 100% of the royalty, because you're not being released from any exclusivity. The companies normally treat your share of royalties exactly the same as all other royalties under your deal. That means they use your share to recoup your deficit, or else pay it to you on your next accounting statement if you're recouped. Sometimes you can get half or all of your share paid to you, even if you're unrecouped. The ability to do this varies directly with your bargaining power. If you get an advance against your royalties, the record company will also want a piece of that. Recoupment. Unlike record deals, where everything is recoupable, in films you can often knock out a good portion, sometimes even all, of the costs. Let's look at them individually. Recording costs. You can sometimes make all or a portion of the recording costs non-recoupable. You do this by arguing that the costs of recording are really costs of the film, which they'd have to spend even if there wasn't an album, and therefore it's not fair to charge these costs against your royalties. If you're a superstar, you can pull it off. If you're not, you'll end up with anywhere from 50% to 100% of the costs being recoupable. Artist's performance fee. Another question is whether any of your fee to record for the film is recoupable from your royalties. Again, you can take the position that this is a fee to perform for the film, not on records, and so they shouldn't recoup it. If you have some bargaining power, you can pull this off. Otherwise, a part of it may be recoupable. As a negotiating ploy, if you want to increase your fee and are getting nowhere, try making a portion of the increase recoupable, but use this as a last resort. Sometimes soundtrack albums are financed by a record company that pays for the music and gets the right to put out the album. We'll discuss these deals in Chapter 33. The monies paid by the record company are advances against the soundtrack album royalties. And because the film performer's fees come out of these advances, all or a portion of the fee is often treated as an advance against the artist's royalties. Conversion costs. As good as all this news sounds, there are costs recouped under film deals that aren't chargeable under record deals. They're not charged under record deals for a simple reason. They don't exist in record deals. These babies are known as conversion costs, a name I take credit for inventing. I'm really a pretty modest guy, but every once in a while, something gets the better of me. Conversion costs are the costs of converting a film recording to a master that can be used in a record. For example, the recording for the film might only be 30 seconds, but you need a 3-minute version for the record. The conversion costs are the costs to do this, and they include the kind of costs you'd expect, such as remixing, editing, overdubbing, additional instruments, called sweetening, and sometimes even totally re-recording the song. But they also include something you haven't seen before, called reuse fees. Whenever you take a recording made for one medium, in this case, a motion picture, and use it in another, like records, the union charges you a fee. These fees are called reuse fees or new use fees because they are charges to reuse an existing recording in a different way, a new use. Reuse fees are also payable when you go the other way around, taking a recording made for records and using it in a film, and in other situations like going from television to records, records to television, records to commercials, etc. The reasoning is that when you use an existing recording, you don't have to hire the singers and musicians you would have needed to re-record the song. Since you're putting union members out of work, the unions allow you to do this only if you pay them an amount listed on a schedule, which is close to union scale for the missed sessions. The reuse fees charged for a particular recording are directly proportionate to the number of performers on the track. Thus, a three-piece band is cheap, and the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra is not. Indeed, for a fully instrumental orchestral soundtrack album, the reuse fees can run $90,000 or more. Conversion costs are almost always recoupable from your royalties. Re-recording restriction. Just like your record deal, soundtrack deals include a re-recording restriction. Refer back to Chapter 13. The period is usually 5 years, but the date can be from recording, from release of the picture, or from release of an album or single. If the date is measured from anything except the date of recording, be sure the restriction period someday expires. For example, if it's measured from release and the track is never released, it goes on forever. Also, even during the restriction, try to exclude live streams, festival broadcasts, TV appearances, and the like. Singles. Another point of contention is the question of whether there will be a single, and if so, who can put out a single with your performances on it. We touched on this in Chapter 13. The whether question depends on scheduling. A single is most helpful to the film if it's a hit right when the film opens. But if you're promoting your own singles around that time, your record company won't want a competing single out there fighting for attention. Assuming there's going to be a single, the next question is, which company will put it out? Historically, the artist's label always kept singles rights because they wanted to coordinate it with their other marketing efforts around you. Then singles got to be unprofitable because, as we discussed, it can be expensive to promote a single, and single sales dwindled. However, in those days, a successful single drove sales of albums, and since the soundtrack distributing company got the profits from the album, it had an incentive to spend money on singles. So the artists' labels quit being so precious and let the soundtrack album companies handle the singles. Then the streaming age arrived. Album profits fell off a cliff, and a soundtrack album became primarily a playlist on the streaming services. Moreover, most consumers don't stream the entire album. They just listen to the tracks they like, meaning everything is basically a single. Now what? Well, it was clear that physical and downloads would be handled by the soundtrack album company. But if those were the only rights they had, they couldn't make enough money to justify their expenses. So the practice now is that all rights, including streaming, are controlled by the soundtrack album distributor. But they pay a large chunk of the money, maybe even 50% of the profits, to the artist's label. Can your record company use the master? As noted earlier, one nice goodie you can sometimes get is the right to use the recording on your own albums. Because of declining album sales, this has become much less of an issue, but for the time being, it's still around. If the film company allows you to use the master on your own album, they'll limit it to one album, or maybe one studio album plus one greatest hits. They'll also say you can't put it on your record for a period of somewhere between 6 months, if you've really got clout, to 2 years, with the norm being around 1 year. The period before you can release the master on your record is called a holdback. The clock may start at release of the picture, release of the soundtrack album, or release of your recording as a single. Whatever you do, make sure the date someday arrives. For example, if you measure your period from release of the soundtrack album, and the album is never released, you could never use it. If you ask, the film company will usually agree to an outside date after which you can use it no matter what. Sometimes your record company wants to put the cut on your own album at the same time as the soundtrack album is out. In other words, there's no holdback. The film company, and especially the record company with the soundtrack album, won't like this at all. But if you're important enough, and it's the only way they can get you, they may go along. When you use the track on your own record, you'll of course get the royalty under your own deal, which is likely higher. However, you're responsible for paying the producer and any other royalty participants. In recent years, with rare exceptions like La La Land or A Star Is Born, for example, soundtrack album sales have been abysmal, so there's been a trend for many pictures not to have a soundtrack album at all. In that case, the only records with the soundtrack cut are the artist's own, and there's obviously no holdback in these situations. When there's no soundtrack album, your label and the film company may nonetheless work together to promote your song as a single. The film company may ask for a piece of your royalty if you use it on your record, and my response is to tell them to stuff it. So far, they've generally stuffed it, even though they may work out a deal with your record label. Music videos. If there's going to be a music video, the record and film company usually share the cost 50-50, and the film company customarily supplies footage from the film at no cost to be included in the video. In the beginning, film companies turned these videos into long previews of the movies. This worked terrifically until the TV broadcasters figured out they were giving away free advertising for the film, at which point the practice came to an abrupt halt. So now there's limited footage from the film in a music video, and in fact, there's usually a second version without any film footage. You should ask for some creative approvals of videos, but this is really hard because the film company, rightly, sees this as marketing for the film. You can usually pull off consultation rights, meaning they talk to you about it, but don't need your approval. Chapter 29. Film Songwriter Deals. Terminology. Let's now look at film songwriter deals. By songwriter deals, I mean deals for songs, both music and lyrics, or sometimes instrumental only, written for the film, as opposed to what's known as the score or underscore, which is background music underneath dialogue, action, etc. We'll deal with underscore in Chapter 30. Also, this chapter deals with creating a song for the film, as opposed to licensing an existing song, not written for the film. Licensing songs is covered in Chapter 31. Deal points. When you write a song for a film, you typically get a fee plus songwriter royalties. If you're a songwriter of even moderate stature, you may be also able to keep a piece of the publishing. Fees. The range of songwriting fees is anywhere from $0 to $100,000 plus for established writers. There are occasionally deals even higher in the stratosphere, but they're rare. Zero is even rarer, but it happens with a low-budget film that has no music budget, and instead of paying, lets the songwriter keep all the publishing. Refer back to Chapter 16, where we talked about the fact that songs and films can earn substantial performance monies in foreign territories, as well as on television here. The majority of deals fall in the range of $25,000 to $50,000 for major studio films. Whether or not the writer gets a part of the publishing also affects the size of the fee. If you're a big-name songwriter, you can sometimes get additional monies called kickers based on the success of the film. For example, you might get more dough if the film does $100 million U.S. box office gross, another kicker at $150 million, etc. There can also be kickers based on streaming numbers and/or singles chart performance. By the way, a film company will never obligate itself to use a song. The most it will do is agree to pay the fee, which is known as pay or play, because it can either use your song, play, or pay you to go away. This is similar to the pay or play provisions in record deals, which we discussed in Chapter 10. If your song isn't used, you should ask them to assign back any interest in the copyright they may have gotten. You may or may not get this, since they paid you the full fee. Step deals. Songwriter deals are sometimes done on a step basis, meaning the deal is done over a series of steps. The steps are: 1. The writer creates the song and gives the company an informal demo recording. They only get a small amount of money for this, or sometimes nothing other than the costs to record the demo. 2. If the film company doesn't like the demo, it either passes or goes to step 2, which requires the writer to rewrite the song for a small additional fee, or maybe no more money. If the company then likes it, it's a firm deal. If not, the deal is off. 3. Once the film company is happy, it goes forward on a pre-negotiated deal to use the song. At this point, the deal is the same as the songwriter deals we just discussed, although I like to ask for more money because we've covered their downside. All of this is a fancy way of saying the writer does it on spec, meaning on speculation. In other words, he or she writes the song without a commitment from the film company to pay a full fee. It may be completely on spec, meaning no writer's fee up front, or the film studio may pay a small fee, usually in the range of $2,500 to $5,000, sometimes as high as one half the normal fee, for writing the song. If the studio likes the song and wants to go forward, it pays the rest of the full fee. If you're a major songwriter, you should do very little on spec, because you don't want to spend your time working on a project that will pay you half or less of your normal fee. Also, rejection is not good for your self-image, unless you get your full fee. It's not great even then, but at least you didn't totally waste your time. If you're doing a step deal, try to get your song back if they don't accept the demo. The studio will only be out a few bucks, and they shouldn't get ownership rights. They, of course, argue that they paid for the demos and may have even given you a small fee, so they should own everything. Still, with some clout, you should be able to get the song back. However, if you use the song elsewhere, the studio will require you to take out any specific melody from the underscore, or any reference to the title, characters, or plot of the film. Another way to get your song back, you didn't hear it here, is to simply not sign anything until the demo is accepted and the deal is firm. Rights granted. Music written for films is always treated as a work for hire. Refer back to Chapter 19. So your contract will have the magic language that makes it so. The film companies insist on this because if it's not a work for hire, you or your heirs could terminate the copyright assignment after 35 years. As we discussed a little later in Chapter 19, there's no termination right for works for hire. If you were able to terminate, you might stop them from exploiting their film, or you might demand a percentage of the gross national product to let them continue. With respect to usage, the film company wants the right to use your song not only in the film, but also in sequels, films that start where the last one left off, prequels, films that take place in time before the film for which the song is licensed, and spin-offs, films with the same characters in different adventures, advertising, co-promotions, refer back to Chapter 28, and out-of-context uses, refer to Chapter 17. If you have a lot of clout, you can sometimes prohibit some or all co-promotions, or at least limit how the song is used in the co-promotion. Refer back to Chapter 28 for limitation on masters. You can get the same things for the song. Over the last several years, film companies have radically expanded the list of things they can do with your song, all without paying you. Studio tours, theme parks, live entertainment, like Broadway shows, ice shows, etc. Storyteller and sing-along records. A TV series based on the film. Film-themed video games. Merchandising. DVD menus. Outtakes, scenes deleted from the film. Making-ofs. Behind-the-scenes footage of filming. Toaster ovens. Just seeing if you're paying attention. And whatever else they can throw in the soup. You usually have to give up these rights, but with some clout, you can get more money for them, either by increasing your original fee or getting additional monies if the song is used in one of these categories. If they agree to pay more, it'll either be a pre-negotiated amount listed in the contract or a requirement for them to pay you a customary fee that you can argue about later. Go for the customary fee if you can. Any fees they list today could be really low by the time you actually get there. Songwriter royalties. Traditional film deals require you to transfer the entire copyright ownership to the film studio, and you get 50% of the song's earnings. As we discussed in Chapter 16, these monies are called the writer share, and the film studio's remaining 50% is called the publisher share. Under these traditional deals, you get no share of the studio's performance monies because you'll be paid directly by the PRO. Refer back to the Sources of Income section in Chapter 16 if you don't remember how this works. Publishing royalties. While the mainstream publishing industry has done away with the distinction between writer share and publisher share, and instead just pays a percentage of total income, as we discussed at the top of Chapter 18, the distinction between writer share and publisher share is alive and well in the film world. That's because songwriters generally just get the writer share of royalties. As we've just discussed, however, if you have some clout, you can sometimes get a piece of the publisher share of income. This is typically from 25% to 50% of the publisher share, along with the same percentage of copyright ownership. So if you get 50% of the publisher share, you'll get A, 100% of the writer's share of income, meaning 50% of the total income, or 50 cents for every dollar that comes in, plus B, 50% of the publisher's share of income, meaning 50% of the remaining 50 cents, or 25 cents, for a total of 75% of every dollar that comes in, 75 cents. However, unlike mainstream publishers, who just say you get 75% of the income, most film studios break out the royalties into two calculations, one for your writer share and a separate one for your piece of the publisher share. And in calculating the publisher share, they may try to deduct an administration fee. Refer back to Chapter 18 for what that means. In fact, if the film studio doesn't administer its own publishing company, it will have an administration deal with another publisher, and that other publisher's fees will come out before they split with you. Some studios will write the deal as 75% of income, and in this case, you'll only get 50% of the publisher's share of performance money. Refer back to the What's in the Pot section of Chapter 18 if you don't remember why. There are a few situations, however, where you can't get a share of the publishing unless you're gargantuan, and even then it's difficult. Those are when you write songs for A, animation films, B, huge franchise movies like Star Wars or Marvel, and C, other 900-pound gorillas who like to beat their chests in this area. When traipsing through the ape habitat, get as much front money as you can to compensate for the fact that you're taking less on the back end. If your song is based on music in the underscore, getting a share of publishing is trickier. As you'll see in the next chapter, underscore composers typically don't get a share of publishing in the score. Thus, since the song includes underscore, the composer won't have a piece of the publishing. But if you're a lyricist who wrote words for the underscore, you can sometimes get a share of publishing for your piece of the song. For example, if you wrote 50% of the song, and the studio is sharing 50% of publishing with the creators, you get half of that 50% publishing, or 25% of the total publishing. Put another way, you have one half of the song, and therefore, A, 50% of the writer's share, 25 cents out of every dollar, plus B, 50% of the 50% share of the publishing income, meaning 25% of the publishing income, 12.5 cents of every dollar. So the grand total is 37.5% of the total income from the song. If you're the underscore composer, and the song is separately identifiable from the underscore, in other words, if it has a distinct name and lyrics, you should argue for a share of publishing on the song, even though you don't share in the same music when it's used in the underscore. We'll discuss this more at the top of Chapter 30. Also, if you're the underscore composer, and you write a song that is not based on a theme in the underscore, you should be able to get a separate songwriter fee and a percentage of that song's publishing income. If you do get a share of publishing, the studios want the exclusive administration rights. Refer back to the top of Chapter 18 for a discussion of administration. If you've got clout, you may be able to keep co-administration, unless it's the title song, where the studio feels it's so identified with the film that they have to keep control. Co-administration is discussed in Chapter 18. Even with co-administration, however, there will be restrictions on sync licenses, as we discussed in connection with masters in the streaming and download section of Chapter 16. E.g., you can't license to another film, TV show, or commercial. If you don't get co-administration, you may still be able to approve certain types of sync licenses, such as commercials, just like in any other songwriting deal. Refer back to the Creative Control section of Chapter 18. But this takes muscle. At a minimum, try for consultation rights on commercials, which means they have to discuss proposed uses with you, but they can make the final decision. Also, try to get paid directly by the soundtrack record company for mechanical royalties, and by your performing rights society for the publisher's piece of performance monies, so you don't have to wait for the money to go through the film company. Some small-budget films will license songs for very little and let the composer keep all ownership, administration, and income from the songs. However, they'll restrict synchronization licenses, as we've discussed. Credit. The other major provision in a songwriter deal is credit. Normally, unless you write the title song and it's performed by a major artist, you get a credit in the crawl. Refer back to the Performance in the Film, No Record Rights section of Chapter 28. If this is the case, there's not much to say except that your credit shouldn't be any less prominent than any other songwriter's. If you do write the main title song, you may be able to get credit on a single card, meaning no one else's credit is on the screen at the same time, except that it can be coupled with the song's performer, such as title song performed by X, written by Y. Possibly you can get your card in the main titles, meaning those listing the stars, director, etc. And if so, you should ask for the size to be no less than that of the writer, director, or film producer. If you're a really major writer, you may be able to get credit in the billing block of paid ads for the film. But this is extraordinarily hard to come by. The billing block is that microscopic box of credits down at the bottom of movie ads. An exception to these rules is where the film features a number of original songs and you're the main songwriter. For example, A Star is Born. In that case, you can get credit in the main titles without sharing with the performer credit, and also in the billing block. However, this credit is usually conditioned on at least 4 or 5 of your songs being featured in the film. Top-level writers may also get a credit in ads for the soundtrack album in Billboard and other trades. Chapter 30. Composer Agreements. Composers are the guys and gals who write the underscore. Underscore, also called score, is the music underneath the dialogue, action, transitions, etc., that you're not supposed to notice. If you've ever seen a film without music, you know how stark and empty it feels. A good underscore can radically increase the impact of a film, just as a bad one can make a movie feel weird and cheap. You may be surprised to hear that most film scoring is no longer done by a full orchestra sitting in a recording studio watching film clips on a giant screen. With the exception of a few old-school composers who don't do electronics, most films are first scored electronically, meaning with just a synthesizer, so the director and producer can approve the music. If it's a small-budget film, that electronic score may be it. For bigger-budget films, once the electronic score is locked, the composer brings in an orchestra, clamps headphones over their ears, and has them listen to the electronic score while they overdub their parts, meaning they replace the synthesized violins with real ones, add acoustic instruments, etc. In some cases, the composer freshly records what was in the electronic score with an orchestra. Deal points. Deals for composers are similar to those for songwriters, except that a composer almost never gets any share of the publishing. Other than extremely low-budget films, where the composer might keep the publishing to compensate for getting little or no fee, the only exception to this publishing ban is where a portion of the underscore is used in a song written for the film. For example, if you're a composer and the studio hires a lyricist to write words for one of your underscore themes, you might get some of the publishing for that song. But you only get it if the stars line up correctly, meaning 1. The music and lyrics constitute a real song with its own title, and 2. The lyricist is getting a piece of the publishing on that song. If the lyricist isn't getting a share of publishing, it's much harder for the composer to get any. Assuming all that works out, and you get a publishing piece, it will only be for that melody when it's used in the song. You won't share in the publishing of that melody when it's used in the underscore. The fee for writing and conducting a major studio theatrical motion picture underscore ranges anywhere from a low of $50,000 to a high of $2 million plus for the superstars. The really big deals are reserved for tentpole pictures, basically meaning the massive releases like Fast and Furious, Avengers, etc., or big-budget animated films. The normal range is from $300,000 to $1 million, though lower-budget independent films are less. More and more, studios want to do package deals, meaning a lump sum that covers both the fee and recording costs, because that makes it easier for them to manage the film budget. The prices are in the same range as just mentioned, but can be $50,000 to $100,000 higher to cover the cost of creating an electronic score. Generally, but not always, the costs of recording live musicians are paid by the studio on top of the package fee. If you can avoid a package, you'll be better off, though that's not always possible. As we'll discuss in a bit, packages can do some serious damage to the composer's pocketbook if things don't go well. Because composer prices have drifted downward over the last few years, more and more studios are open to the idea of bonuses based on box office gross. For example, you might get $50,000 for every $25 million of box office. The size of each bonus and the levels where you kick in are very deal-specific, depending on the budget of the film, the size of your fee, and that ever-present factor, your clout. Historically, the bonuses were based only on U.S. box office, but now you can get kickers for worldwide box office. If you do, the worldwide number is around 2 times the U.S. number, though one studio uses 2.25 times U.S. In other words, if your bonus is based on $100 million U.S. box office gross, it would kick in at a worldwide box office of $200 million. You should say that you get your bonus on the first to occur of these, U.S. or worldwide, in case the worldwide distribution is delayed or the foreign grosses suck. If your bonuses are based on worldwide gross, by the way, the studio will count only a portion of the gross in China. That's because the government takes a huge tariff on foreign films. By the way, you can only get worldwide bonuses from studios that own the international distribution rights to the film. Studios sometimes sell off foreign rights to independent distributors for large guarantees that help finance the film. And in those cases, the studio makes little or no additional money from the foreign grosses. So it can only base your bonus on U.S. and maybe Canadian earnings. As to other deal points, most of the issues we discussed in Chapter 29 concerning songwriters also apply to composers. However, there are some weird twists that live only in composer land, so let's take a walk down that crooked path. Delivery date. Interestingly, composer deals have no term. They go on until the composer delivers the score, which could mean the composer works on a film for 4 or 5 months, sometimes even years. The process starts with spotting, which means the composer and director determine precisely which spots need music, as well as the exact length of each piece needed, measured in tenths of seconds. Historically, spotting happened only when there was a final cut of the film, meaning there wouldn't be any more changes. With animation, and with films that add a lot of special effects after they've been shot, it's not uncommon for the composer to get chunks of the film over time. In this case, they do the spotting and composing for each of the pieces as they come. Whether the film comes to the composer in pieces or in one big glorious package, it's common for directors to keep making changes all along, which means the music has to keep adjusting. This is more serious than it sounds. A change of even 1 second in a scene may require a total rewrite of the music, because a well-written score moves precisely with the action on screen, and even a slight variation throws everything out of whack. It's like a marching band doing an extra half step between beats. So changes mean the composer goes back to the drawing board, though sometimes a good music editor can creatively edit existing music to the new scene. Anyway, because there's no end date, you could be tied up for a long time. Which brings us nicely to our next topic. Exclusivity. Composer deals used to be exclusive until delivery of the score, which meant you couldn't do anything else during that time. Since the studios no longer limit how long they can keep you working, it goes until you finish, you have to insist that your deal is non-exclusive, meaning you can take other work rather than starve. The studio will agree to this, but only if you agree that the other work won't prevent you from delivering to them on time. The studios all require exclusivity at the end, from the time you actually start recording the score until you finish. Payment schedule. Historically, before you got any money, the studios made you sign something called a Certificate of Authorship, also known to its friends as a C of A. This is a one-page document that says they own everything you do, and the problem is that you're giving up ownership without having the deal fully negotiated. So once you sign it, you lose a lot of leverage. More and more, studios have now adopted a policy of not paying any money until the full contract is signed. Because these deals can be pretty complex, this policy can seriously delay your paycheck. So if you're working for one of these studios, it's a good idea not to do too much work before the contract is signed. Composers normally get their fees in either thirds or fourths. If it's in thirds, you usually get one-third on spotting, one-third on commencement of recording, and one-third on completion of services. If you're paid in fourths, expect one-fourth upon spotting, one-fourth on commencement of recording, one-fourth on completion of recording, and the balance on completion of services. Completion of recording is almost always the same as completion of services, but occasionally you have to stick around and help with dubbing the music into the picture, editing for the soundtrack album, sweeping the floor, etc. Major composers can speed up the payment schedule a bit. Here's a recent deal. It's in thirds and sixths, but it could also be fourths as well. One-third on commencement of services and execution of the agreement, one-third on commencement of recording, one-sixth on delivery of the score, and one-sixth on completion of all services. The studios that pay based on a C of A will hold back some money until signature of the full agreement, which may be well after the services have started or finished. The range is from 10% to one-third of the total fee. Orchestrations. It may surprise you to know that many composers don't have the ability to write musical parts for each instrument in their orchestras. In fact, some composers don't even read music, although this is rare. These guys are known in the trade as hummers. Most of us assume that all film composers are like John Williams, who is a premier orchestral arranger and who understands the subtleties of every instrument. However, many composers only write the melody line for the underscore, then give it to an orchestrator, who writes out the parts for the trumpets, oboes, clarinets, violins, etc. Next time you see a film, look for the orchestrator's credit, buried among the assistants, makeup people, grips, and gaffers, whatever they are. Orchestrators aren't used only by composers who are incapable of writing their own instrumental parts. Quite the contrary. Virtually all composers use orchestrators, if for no other reason than to save the time and/or tedium of mechanically doing it themselves. However, classically trained composers often sketch out the parts pretty thoroughly, and the orchestrator then becomes more of a copyist. By the way, I know of one situation where a composer, under extreme time pressure to finish a film, hired three orchestrators at the same time to crank out the parts. The orchestrator is, of course, paid for his or her services. If it's the composer or a primary orchestrator, they get a negotiated fee, usually in the range of $80 per page of score. Second and third orchestrators are generally paid union scale, but the better-known ones can get more. Scale for orchestrators varies with the size of the orchestra and number of pages of music. If the film is non-union, the per-page fee will usually increase to about $140 per page because there are no residuals. Residuals are royalties that the studios pay to union members when the film is used other than in theaters, such as on television and in streaming. If it's a non-union project, there are no residuals, so the orchestrator loses money and is entitled to more upfront. As a rough guideline, at the time of this writing, the price for simple orchestrations is roughly $400 per minute of music, e.g., 30 minutes is $12,000, though complex orchestrations can exceed $30,000 for a film. Orchestrators also can get something called a booth monitor fee, which means you get paid to hang out in the recording studio's control booth while the session is being recorded, in case the score needs some last-minute help. Booth monitor fees are payable through the AFM, if the project is a signatory to the union, and they're roughly a double-scale payment per session, though if there are two orchestrators, they each get a single-scale payment for booth monitoring. An important part of your composer deal is to negotiate whether your composer's fee includes orchestrations. Even if the film company knows you aren't capable of doing this job, you may be responsible for paying the orchestrator out of your fee. Conversely, you may be perfectly capable of doing orchestrations, but A, your time doesn't permit it, B, you're only willing to do the orchestrations if you're paid additional money for the trouble, or C, you're not in the mood. Either way, you should make sure the orchestration fees are on top of your composer fee. If you don't raise this issue, the film company may try to deduct the cost of orchestrations from your money. Of course, if you're doing a package deal that includes everything, as we'll discuss in a minute, the orchestrator fees are part of the package cost. Record royalties. A film composer isn't a performer, so it's not automatic that you get record royalties. Underscore royalties are only paid if you are A, conducting the orchestra, and or B, producing the recordings. Sometimes the composer does neither of those. Let's look at the royalties separately. Conducting royalties. When conducting, the composer becomes, in a sense, a recording artist by leading the orchestra. The customary range of these royalties is 6% to 10%, though some studios won't go beyond 9%. Prorated by the number of cuts, refer back to the Coupling and Compilation section of Chapter 12 for a discussion of proration, and further prorated for royalty artists on any particular cut. Refer back to the Guest Artists, Featured Artists, and Joint Recordings section of Chapter 12 for a discussion of joint recordings. In the real world, many composers don't actually conduct. Instead, they hire a conductor and buy out his or her royalties for a fee payable through the musician's union, if the project is a signatory to the union. The fee is roughly double or triple scale payment per session. Once they pay the actual conductor, the composer then steps into their shoes and gets the conductor royalty. Producing royalties. If you produce the recordings, see the top of Chapter 11 for what producing is, you can get 3% to 4%. Note, this is independent of conducting royalties. You can produce even if you don't conduct, or vice versa. Like other producer royalties, these are retroactive to Record 1 after recoupment. Refer to the Royalty section of Chapter 11 for a discussion of retroactivity. Historically, producing didn't mean much more than remixing the masters, since no one really produced music that had already been recorded for the film. However, since a lot of scores are now electronically pre-recorded, as we discussed earlier in this chapter, composers are in fact doing more production. They first produce the pre-recorded synthesizer score, then, after the orchestra overdubs the pre-record, they produce and mix the final product. You can usually insist on producing the underscore for records, but composers have had singularly bad luck imposing themselves as producers of songs. This is because artists may simply refuse to work with them. The best you can do is say that the film company must use you as the producer of all songs if the artist and record company approve. Sounds great, but unfortunately, it's almost meaningless. Most artists don't want a film composer producing them. Of course, if a composer is a producer of note in his own right, that's a different story. The studios will insist on reducing your royalty if you produce the recordings and then another producer comes in later and reworks your cuts. Try to have this only happen with your permission, and in any event, try not to go below 50% of your producing royalty. Floors. Major composers can sometimes get a floor, meaning that if you do absolutely nothing on the record, you still get a royalty. Usually it's a guarantee of one or two cuts on the album, although they don't really guarantee to include your cuts. They only agreed to pay you as if your cuts were included. In other words, if you have a 10% royalty and there are 10 masters on the album, you would be guaranteed 1% or 2%, even if you don't have any recordings on it. you should also argue for an imputed mechanical royalty on those tracks, since you would have been paid one if the tracks were actually included. A guaranteed minimum is relatively easy to get when the album is mostly underscore, but it gets difficult to impossible if you're working on a film with a number of pop songs, like a Quentin Tarantino movie. The reason is obvious. The company has to pay royalties to a lot of expensive outside artists, and there's no assurance there will even be any score selections on the album, if any. Because CDs and downloads are fading, and most everything is a single-song stream, the guaranteed minimum issue has become much less relevant, but it's still worth asking for. Some very major composers get a guarantee that there will be a score album released. Many films don't release score albums, even if they release song albums. However, in recent years, this has been extremely hard to come by, since there are so few soundtrack albums being made, and they don't sell very well. But couldn't the studio just throw out an album on the streaming services to satisfy the composer's ego? What's the big deal? Well, it's actually very expensive to do that. Can you figure out why? Score yourself 100 points if you remembered that you have to pay conversion costs when you put film music in another medium, records in this case, and that can be really expensive for an orchestral album. Conversion costs are discussed in Chapter 28. Recoupment. With composers, the record company normally recoups only conversion costs. The argument is over what royalty they're really recouped from. The best is to have them recouped from the gross royalty payable to all participants, and the worst is recoupment from your artist/conductor royalty. The bigger the royalty rate that's used for recoupment, the faster you'll get paid. Most deals say that you won't get paid until the film studio has recouped everything that's charged against the studio's royalty, which could be advances to other folks that can slow you down quite a bit. Your argument is that most of the studio's advances were used to pay artist advances and recording costs, and therefore the studio will be able to recoup those costs from the artist's royalties. Accordingly, it's not fair for them to take these advances and costs out of the overall royalties before paying you. Sometimes you can pull this off, and sometimes the studio will agree only if the record company agrees. Try to get the record company to pay your royalties directly to you once the conversion costs have been recouped. The studios don't like to do this, so you'll have to fight. But you'll get the royalties faster if they're paid directly to you rather than to the film company, who won't pay them for another accounting period. Credit. 1. Credit in the film. Composers normally get main title, single card credit. Refer back to Chapter 28 for a discussion of film credits. 2. Paid ads. All composers can get credit in paid ads where the full billing block of film credits appears. Mid-level to major composers can get credit in ads even if the only credits are the writer, film producer, and director. Refer back to the end of Chapter 29 about paid ads. 3. Soundtrack album credit. Composer credit on soundtrack albums has historically been a hot issue, though it's becoming less relevant as CD sales fade. As we discussed, the composer isn't really an artist. He or she only wrote the music, and maybe conducted it or produced the record. So it's not a foregone conclusion that the composer will get credit on the soundtrack album, which means you gotta ask. Ideally, you want credit on the front cover of the soundtrack album, or the digital artwork equivalent. The film company will argue, correctly, that it doesn't control this. It's up to the soundtrack album record company. So you'll probably end up with a commitment for the film company to use its reasonable efforts to get you front cover credit. Whether you get front cover credit also depends on the nature of the album. If it's a compilation of songs by major artists, you're not likely to get credit on the front cover. Bluntly, your name won't mean as much as the names of the artists. However, if it's a 50% or more score album, front cover credits shouldn't be too difficult. You should always insist, and the film company should have no trouble agreeing, that you get credit anywhere that the songwriters and artists are credited. The exact credit can sometimes be a tussle as well. Composers want the credit "music by," but if there is other music in the film, the studios want to say "score by" or "underscore by" or "flowers by." Okay, I made up the last one to see if you were sleeping. The composers fight hard for "music by." Other uses. As we discussed earlier, film companies take the right to use music in more than just the film for which you're hired. As the composer, you pretty much have to go along, but the question is whether you can get more money for any other uses. As noted in the last chapter, with enormous clout, songwriters can sometimes get paid for sequels, prequels, and spin-offs. However, composers normally don't get additional monies for that or anything else related to the original film, even in situations where the film company gets money. Refer back to Chapter 28 for a laundry list. One exception, if you ask, is for ringtones and master tones. Refer back to Chapter 12 for what these are, if the film company gets paid. For those, you can get a songwriter royalty for the ringtone mechanicals and a record royalty, whatever percentage you negotiated, on the master tone sales. Travel expenses. It's not uncommon for composers to travel to places where it's cheaper to record, like England, Ireland, Czech Republic, Germany, or Canada, or the slightly less exotic Seattle and Salt Lake City. In this case, you should negotiate for reimbursement of your expenses. On a high-class, big-budget picture, this is usually business-class travel, unless you're Godzilla, or unless it's a very long flight, in which case you can sometimes pull off first class, plus something in the neighborhood of $2,000 to $3,500 per week for New York or London. Sometimes you can get first-class accommodations plus $100 to $150 per day for all expenses besides the hotel. This is called a per diem, which is Latin for per day, but it could also be Slovakian for "you're standing on my flute." For low-budget flicks, you'll get Greyhound tickets and Motel 6 vouchers. If you're going to a foreign country, it's important to get your expense money in the local currency, as you don't want to be in the business of speculating whether the dollar is going to be worth more or less than the peso. For example, suppose your London hotel room costs £100 per night, which at the time of your deal is $150. If your deal is $150 per night in dollars, and if the dollar drops against the pound so that your $150 only equals £90, you're in trouble. The room is £100, but you only get £90 for your $150. So you'll be coming up £10 short. If your deal says you get £100, you're covered. For this reason, it's better to require the studio to cover the hotels and give you a per diem on top. Package deals. As we touched on earlier, some composers do package deals, especially in television and low-budget or independent films. As we discussed, a package is very much like a fund in record deals. Refer back to Chapter 9 for a discussion of funds. In other words, the composer agrees to deliver a completed score for a set dollar amount, and this money includes both the compensation for the composer's services and the costs of recording the score. Not surprisingly, most package deals are done by composers who create electronic scores. In other words, they use a small number of musicians, sometimes only the composer, to create music on a synthesizer, which these days can sound like the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields. There are some score package deals that use real orchestras, but they tend to be for really big money. We'll discuss how big in a minute. In these deals, the composer gets the film's entire music budget, less only the amount the studio thinks it'll need to license existing songs and recordings and/or to create new songs and recordings. There is also a hybrid package, which consists of synthesizer recordings mixed with orchestral recordings. See the next section. Package prices. The price of packages can be anywhere from $50,000 for a low-budget film up to $1,800,000 or even $2 million plus for a mainstream big-budget feature. Though packages in big-budget films are rare, they are mostly low-budget creatures. The really large packages are most common on films where the film producer requires the score to be recorded outside the United States, which is often done for tax reasons. Pure electronic scores, or electronic scores with up to maybe 10 musicians in a package, for major studio films, run around $100,000 to $400,000, sometimes a bit higher for top-level folk. The hybrid packages just described, both synthesizer and score, have a package price of $50,000 to $200,000 for the synthesizer portion, plus b, a market rate fee, sometimes as low as union scale, for the composer's orchestration and conducting services, plus c, the costs of the orchestra and orchestrations, which is paid by the studio on top of the fee, meaning they're not part of the package. At the lower end, I've seen starving composers do low-budget film scores for a $5,000 to $10,000 package price. In this case, you should try to keep the publishing, and sometimes you can get the soundtrack album as well. Even if you can't keep those, you should get a nice chunk of the income from publishing and records, since you're taking so little up front. Exclusions. If you're going to make a package deal, you have to worry about exactly what you have to deliver in the package. Most contracts just require you to deliver all music, and the trick is negotiating what's not included. This turns out to be more complicated than you'd think, and through the courtesy of my friend Michael Gorfain, one of the most experienced film music agents in the business, I bring you the following list of exclusions. Licensing of outside music, i.e., songs not written by the composer for this project. Since most contracts say you must provide all music, I've seen film companies license an expensive outside tune and expect the composer to pay for it. You can't control the costs of outside songs. Indeed, one license could eat half your package fee, so never agree to this. Note, you want the exclusion stated as songs not written by the composer for this project. Some composers have a library of cues they've previously written, and there's an issue whether these should be excluded from the package price. We'll discuss these babies coming up. Recording costs of outside music. If the sessions for outside music can't be scheduled during the normal scoring sessions, their costs shouldn't be included in the package. Reuse fees. Refer back to Chapter 28 for a discussion of reuse fees. Not your problem, but 1. You can't exclude reuse fees from the package if you're composing for a non-union film. The reason is that there won't be any union reuse fees for non-union musicians, which is what the film producer wants. Meaning, if you hired a union person, the studio will make you pay their residuals. So watch it. 2. Even if it's a union project, if you make a deal where you own the masters, reuse fees will be your responsibility. That's because your exploiting the masters apart from the movie will trigger a reuse fee, and since the studio doesn't share in that income, they won't bear the expense. Rescoring. This is one of the most important and trickiest areas. The concept is to save your rear end if the director says he wants an angelic harp accompanying his scene, which you record and deliver, only to have him decide later that he really meant hip-hop. In other words, if the film people require you to re-record for reasons totally beyond your control, as opposed to your screw-up, it should be on them. Lyricist expenses. If the studio wants a lyricist to write words to your music, it should be on their nickel. Vocalist expenses. As with lyricists, if the company wants somebody to croon your newly created song, they should.